Petrovic, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Now, 10 minutes after 8, just ahead of the morning show with Greg Berg, let's check WGTD Sports and Weather. In the NBA, the Bucks and Bulls were both off last night. Tonight, the Bucks play Indiana. The Bulls host Memphis. In the NHL, the Blackhawks lost to Boston last night, 6-3. They're off tonight. College basketball, number 10 Marquette dispatched DePaul pretty easily, 92-73. Meanwhile, the 20th-ranked UW Badgers lose to Michigan State, 67-59. Now the WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service for this Wednesday, February the 13th. Sunny, windy, and seasonal. Today's high 26 with winds up to 20 miles per hour. Here are the numbers now. 15 degrees Kenosha, 18 Racine, wind from the west at 10, wind chill 9 above. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, welcoming approximately 150 full-time transfer students each year. Eligible Gateway graduates can receive guaranteed admission to Carthage to complete their bachelor's degrees. Transfer to a more personalized education in 4 easy steps. More information about admissions and competitive scholarships for transfers is available at carthage.edu/admissions/transfer. And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. And I am tremendously honored indeed to be spending most of today's morning show with James and Deborah Fallows. And I'm sure many of you know James Fallows from the remarkable work that he has done for The Atlantic for more than 3 decades, and the author of a number of different books, and his commentaries have been heard extensively over NPR. And Deborah Fallows is a fine writer in her own right and holds a PhD in theoretical linguistics, the author of 2 previous books. She has contributed to The Atlantic as well as Slate, The New York Times, and other outlets as well. And together, they have forged a most impressive professional and personal life together. And that personal and professional partnership certainly took an exciting turn with a project that resulted in a brand new book called Our Towns, a 100,000-mile journey into the heart of America. James Fallows and Deborah Fallows traveled together across the country, visiting places like Columbus, Ohio, Burlington, Vermont, Charleston, West Virginia, Bend, Oregon, Dodge City, Kansas, you name it, over the course of several different years. And out of that experience came this vivid portrait of America and very crisp portraits of all of these different communities across the country and the people who live there, their struggles, their successes, where they've been, where they might be headed. It is a fascinating book and such a marvelous idea. The book, by the way, is published by Pantheon Books. And James and Deborah Fallows, as you have heard over the air of WGTD, are very special guests of Carthage College next week. And I am thrilled at this opportunity to speak with them ahead of their visit to Carthage. James Fallows, Deborah Fallows, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much, Greg. Great to talk with you. And Deb and I are on separate phones, so you'll have to choreograph using your musical skill, choreograph when we each enter.
Well, just watch the baton very closely and let's see what happens. I am so excited about this, and I really, really loved your book. I want to confess that when I heard about what you had done, it reminded me ever so slightly of certain other books in which an author will go to a lot of different places and write down their impressions and so on. It's not as though that has never been done before. I was not prepared for how different this book would feel from those that have come before that have been, in a sense, roughly similar, at least in their aim. I wonder if the two of you were mindful of the fact that books roughly like this have been written, and how consciously were you anxious to craft something that would be truly new?
So, Deb, you want to start or me?
Sure, I'll take that to start. We read as much as we could about people who had been on adventures around the country, everything from Tocqueville, which is pretty heavy-duty reading, to Steinbeck in his camper as he drove around, and Studs Terkel looking at working people, Lewis and Clark, who were greater adventurers than any of us as they set out in their pirogues and followed creeks and rivers and over mountains and so forth. And Mark Twain himself. But we found those very inspiring and not intimidating, because we didn't start out with a great mission or ambition in mind. We started out with something much less formidable, which was we thought we would go to a couple towns just to see how they were reacting in this rather post-recession era about 2011, 2013. To see what had happened in those towns when, after the factory closed or the mine closed or the mill closed, were they addressing their problems? Were they doing better? Were they doing worse? Did they care? Did they have hopes and dreams, or were they depressed? So we really had no idea at the beginning of this that it would grow into a 4-year-plus project of several dozen towns. We just thought it would kind of be more of a lark to visit one or two places. So that is really the origin of how it started, and it ended up connecting to these longer writing that people did about traveling around the country. But its beginning was much more modest.
Hmm. Mr. Fallows, anything to add?
Well, Deb always has the right and authoritative word in all things. I'll say first, of course, I agree. And I think that we there's a reason that the road trip narrative is such a staple of American self-awareness and American literature from the 1700s onward, you know, the Oregon Trail or Blue Highways or whatever, because there is such an expanse of the country, and there is such a logic to the landscape going from east to west, following the paths of European settlement, and just there are different regional identities. And we were making this trip, of course, in our little tiny propeller plane, which allows you to go to lots of places that are not on interstates and see things from 2,000 feet up. So we both we were aware of and trying to do an homage to the standard American road trip by saying, here is the way the U.S. Appears at this moment in its history.
Mm. I really appreciated the fact that in the introduction you take some time to talk about this choice to fly rather than drive across America. And it's so intriguing, because I think most of us who don't get to do that, I mean, even if we've occasionally flown for kind of special occasions, I don't know anybody who's ever done anything like what you have done in terms of exploring the country but by plane. And it was not a capricious decision on your part. I mean, you saw real benefit in exploring the country in this way. Explain what some of those benefits were to doing this by plane, in a sense.
So, Deb, I will start, and then you can correct me.
Yes,
and fill
sir,
us
you're
in.
The pilot.
So we have, for a long time, enjoyed flying around the country in a little tiny single-engine propeller plane. This is a Cirrus SR-22. It's made actually in Duluth by two brothers, a company founded by two brothers originally from Wisconsin. And what we found over the years is, first, there's a real aesthetic uniqueness to seeing the American landscape from a couple thousand feet up. You realize when you're driving around the country in a car, you're seeing everything from road level. And when you're traveling, and same thing for a train, if you're traveling in an airliner from coast to coast or any normal airliner, you're seeing it from too high up to really notice many of the details. Many people just pull down the shades and sleep or watch a movie or whatever. But from 2,500 feet up, you have a real sense of sort of, it's like swimming through the air at the kind of altitude and with the kind of perspective kids often dream about when they're flying through their hometowns. And you can see how settlement proceeded from the East Coast to the West and why people went through the gaps in the mountains they did and why towns are located on lakes and on rivers and by falls and all the rest. You can see the things that towns want to highlight, the sort of prideful parts of their downtowns. You can see the things they're trying to hide, like prisons and quarries and junk car lots on their periphery, and it just gives you a perspective of how things fit together. Also, every place in the U.S. is within a few miles of a small airport. There's 5,000 of them around the country, so it's a way to get to places that you might not otherwise get if you're just on the big Interstate 80.
And I would just like to be sure that we set the record straight with your listeners here that while Jim and I feel it was a tremendous privilege to be able to fly around in this small plane and how lucky we were to do that, this was not like flying around in net jets or exec jets. This is a pretty rough and ready little plane in that there is no bathroom, there is no flight attendant, there is no food. If it's cold outside, you're freezing. If it's hot outside, you're really hot and sweating. If it's bright, you try to find some shade from the sun that's beating down. If it's windy and turbulent, you bounce all over the place. So it is more like being on horseback or in a canoe than it is being in a jetliner.
Right. And I chuckled at a point in the book early on when you are describing yourself, Mrs. Fallows, as not a pilot and of very limited assistance to your husband. I think one of the examples you give is when he would ask if you could spot the runway and you would mumble a hesitant answer even to as basic a question as that. I trust that as this trip proceeded, you started to feel more and more, in a sense, at home and maybe a little more aware of all it means to fly.
Yeah, just a bit about pilots. To be a pilot like Jim is, you have to be a completely dedicated, passionate person. It's not like you just get your license like you do for a car and then forever and ever you can drive a car. It takes a tremendous amount of upkeep and maintenance and recertification to continue to be a safe pilot, especially with the increasing technology and all the new updates and software that come into your plane. That is Jim's passion, but I grew to appreciate it tremendously. First, for its functionality, you can just get pretty quickly from place to place, and then for all the aesthetic reasons that Jim talks about, flying into the clouds and out of the clouds and soaring like a bird and all of those things. There is one very special thing about our plane, which is that it has a parachute built into the entire fuselage of the plane. So in extreme cases where, say, Jim could no longer pilot the plane, I could do that myself, but I could even better pull the parachute, and we would float down like those little planes you had as a kid, the little balsa wood planes with parachutes on them that kind of swing back and forth. And it's not something that you do in any cavalier sense. You don't want to do that. But if it's really up against the wall in a matter of life and death, it can be done, and it has been done. And the 80 times or so in the last 20-some years that this plane has been manufactured, everyone who has pulled that parachute has walked away with a life. His own life, her own life.
We're talking about the entire fleet, which is now the most popular small plane in the world because of the parachute. Of 7,000 or 8,000 planes, there have been a total of 70-plus parachute deployments in the last 20 years. Everybody has walked away.
Very good. And we should mention, too, you might have said this, Mr. Fallows, as you were kind of describing some of the particulars of your flight, that this was done at low altitude. And at one point in the introduction, you say, the beauty of this experience comes from the unending fascination of watching the American landscape unfurl below. And you contrast that at some point to what you call as the normal grim airliner perspective. And I'd never stopped to think about that, but they're almost two completely different experiences in terms of what one gets to see and what one gets to truly experience.
It's true. And so I should say also for context, as Deb does, that over the past, over the 3 or 4 years we were doing these travels, about 1% of the time was in the airplane. The other 99% was in the towns and staying for a couple of weeks in each place. But that 1% is memorable because there's almost nothing about commercial airline travel now which is sort of uplifting for the soul. Yes, it's phenomenally safe, and that is to the credit of everybody involved there. And yes, it's something that commerce and everything else depends on, but it is the line about there being flying buses is basically true. And the sense of magic that comes from doing what human beings had aspired to for millennia and being able to see our home planet from above, that is pretty much not what people are thinking about when they're taking Southwest Airlines from Providence to wherever. But when you are flying a couple thousand feet up, high enough above the ground so that you're not annoying people with the noise and you're above the trees and broadcasting towers, but low enough so that you're below a lot of the weather and so that you can see in a beautiful way, it really is like seeing a child's 3D map of the world, of just seeing how the country all fits together. And I could go on for the next 5 hours about this, but I'll encourage everybody to become a pilot.
Absolutely.
I'll say one other thing, that when planes were being invented 100-plus years ago, the assumption was every artist, every poet, every novelist, every sort of creative person would want to become a pilot because of this unique perspective.
Mm-hmm. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with James Fallows and Deborah Fallows about their remarkable new book called Our Towns, a 100,000-mile journey into the heart of America. Over the course of several years, they spent 2 weeks at a time in about 25 different cities across the country, and then shorter visits to a number of other communities as well. One of the things I so appreciated about this book, let's take this to you, Mrs. Fallows, first, is that...
Please call me Deb.
Okay, is the fact that you don't pretend in this book to have seen more than you did. That is, for as extensive as this journey was, taking you to, it feels like, every corner of our country, and for the thoroughness with which you tried to explore, you have no illusions of having really gotten to know any of these places, or you make no pronouncements about what this place really is and what it is destined to become. I in a sense, I guess what I'm appreciating about your book is its ambition and yet its humility. Could you talk about that and whether or not that also was very consciously kind of woven into the way you did this and wrote about it?
Oh, thank you. Maybe this started because Jim and I both grew up in small towns. Jim's from Southern California. I'm from your part of the country, a different Great Lake. I grew up in a small town in northern Ohio on Lake Erie. It's called Vermilion. And having had that experience of growing up in a town of 10,000 or 25,000 people, we know how complex the fabric of a town can be, and know that if we were in a town for 2 weeks or 3 weeks, we couldn't possibly know all of the ins and outs of what was going on there. But coming from that sense of being comfortable in small towns and what it's like to live there, I think we very naturally gravitated toward this experience of writing about them. And when you talk about the humility of this, I'm very proud or honored that you spotted that and said it, because we often, Jim and I, would say to each other how grateful and excited we were that people would open up their hearts and talk so thoroughly and passionately and energetically about what was going on in their own hometowns in very personal terms, that they were pleased that somebody was interested and they wanted to talk. And we were, in a way, it's hard to go in and have people open up their hearts to you and tell you everything that's going on and then leave. It feels a little bit like a betrayal that you were there, they told you so much, and then you have to go away. So we did very much try to be true to the stories that we listened to and to spot the themes that were important, whether it was the development of Main Street or how hard people were working on their new creative schools or the difficulties that many towns face, like the opioid epidemic or how to recover from a main industry when that industry went away. So I am very proud that you actually spotted that sense of listening and sense of reporting. I would say one more thing about it. It was that we did feel, after we'd been in a town for a few weeks at a time, that we felt pretty sure that we were getting the right stories when we started to hear time after time the same story coming out from six or seven or eight different people. We finally thought, okay, you know, there is a truth here. You just kind of finally have an instinct that what you're hearing is the right thing, other than just hearing it once and believing whoever says it first.
Right. I'm glad you said that, because it occurred to me that I tried to imagine if the two of you had, for instance, Racine, Wisconsin on your itinerary, that's where my wife and I live, and if we had bumped into you in the coffee shop and had struck up a conversation, and if I had been charged with telling you my impressions of where I live, I think I would have been one of those people who would have been prone to really accentuate the positive in a really big way. That's just kind of the way I'm wired, and particularly when I talk about Racine, not that I'm not aware of its shortcomings or the challenges it faces, but that's not what I would be personally apt to talk about. And I can think of other people in my life, perfectly decent human beings, who would be exactly the opposite, who would find themselves speaking from a very different place, seeing the community through a very different lens, much more acutely aware of its problems. And it occurred to me that as you visited these different places, you were seeing people from both of those poles and everything in between. And I should think that was a challenge, to sort out where is the truth about this place, or how many truths are there?
So, yes, and that also is a very acute and astute observation about what we were doing. One thing we found is, as the travel went on and the years went on, we went intentionally to more and more obviously troubled places. We spent a lot of time in northern Mississippi. I'm from the small town of Redlands, California, which is right next to San Bernardino, which some of your listeners may have heard of. It was, of course, a scene of a tragic shooting a couple of years ago. It's been a long-term bankrupt city. It's probably the most challenged city in California, perhaps in the entire country. And so, as in the initial first couple weeks of travel, we went places like Sioux Falls, South Dakota, and Holland, Michigan, and essentially asked, what's going on here? And we're hearing about some of the things that were moving in a positive direction. Again, the longer we went on, the more difficult and obviously challenged places we went to see, in these places that have had factories closing and opioid epidemics and political problems and you name it, did people feel that the direction of events was more positive or more negative? And every place we went, people were aware of all the problems of the U.S. right now, from homelessness, again, to opioids, to economic dislocation. And the question was the trend. And we felt most places, most people felt as if most things were going in a positive rather than a negative direction, no matter the level they were starting out at.
Hmm. I want to point out two things from the chapter on your hometown of Redlands, California, that I thought were especially interesting, and invite either of you to chime in. It is in that chapter that you point out the importance of something that might be called local patriotism. This is at a point when you're talking about the struggles that Redland has confronted and some of the encouraging ways in which they've tried to meet those challenges. And it comes down to a lot of different things. But you say that these local attachments plus local ownership and the sense of local patriotism we felt in places otherwise as dissimilar as Sioux Falls and the Golden Triangle and Redlands really matter in the fate of a town. I should think that's one of the kind of central lessons of this whole project and this book, is that sense of what really matters in in what happens to a community. And that sense of local patriotism is one of the most important factors.
Deb, over to you.
Well, Jim, it's your hometown. I think you should take the lead on that one.
But there was a ceremony in Redlands about a year or two ago where Deb, who first visited my parents there when we were college sweethearts and soon about to get married, she was declared an official Redlander. So she has a badge and everything. But yes, there is one minor limitation or frustration I know to saying that these local attachments and citizens or school teachers or philanthropists or politicians or just ordinary people, that it makes such a difference that some of them decide that the future of this community matters, because that's hard to say, okay, that here's a policy for the entire nation. And you can't manufacture local patriots. But what we thought we could do was observe how widespread it is and how important it is. I'll give just one other quick illustration from something in the general vicinity in Holland, Michigan, on the eastern shore of Lake Michigan. That's a town with enormous, just crippling Siberian levels of snow. And a local business person there decided about 20 years ago that one of the ways to help rebuild the city was to have a scheme of routing waste heat from the power plant in plastic tubing underneath all the downtown streets and sidewalks and just melt the snow all winter. And this guy said he would pay the setup costs so the city would maintain it. And it's had this hugely transformative effect of having a snow-free downtown when there are 10-foot snowbanks half a mile away in the town of Holland, Michigan. So we were just impressed by how much of that there was.
And Jim's hometown is kind of a poster child, I think, for local patriotism. It has a really strong history, and as do many towns. But one thing that Redlands does really well is to cultivate that sense of tradition and patriotism, to pass it on from generation to generation. And right now, we saw something really interesting, which is that it was primarily the older half of the population who had started a lot of the traditions of the civic clubs and the social clubs and so forth. But they were passing some of these on to the younger generation, young parents, young families, who were doing a lot more things that were kind of relevant to this era and to this day and age, having market nights every week, having bike rides around the town that were, celebrations where people would come in nationally, parades at every possible chance. And at the library, they established this program where every single child and every single fourth grader in the public schools in Redlands had this segment of social studies where they'd pile onto a bus, drive around town, and learn about all the historic sites in the town. This is the first orange grove. This is where the founders were. Here is where Andrew Carnegie came to help dedicate the new library 100 years ago. So that these 10-year-old, 9-year-old kids had a sense of the place where they lived and what they should know about it and what they could be proud of about it. So, these were very simple things, but they were also very self-consciously orchestrated events of the town that kept alive and grew the patriotism in the town.
Wow. Sometimes the simple things make the most difference, and especially when thoughtfully applied. I love that. Something else in this same chapter, and this reminds me, too, that one of the things I like about your book is that even in the middle of this chapter where we are mostly reading about Redlands, California, you are drawing in reminiscences and observations of other places that you visited in a way that is not intrusive, but I just think just makes the book just that much richer. But in this chapter, you start talking about a certain pool in Redlands, California. And you write, you might be tempted to think a pool is a pool, but I have to tell you that you'd be wrong. A public pool, like a public library, often reveals something about the spirit and culture of a town. Sometimes it's bright side, and sometimes it's dark. I appreciate that so much. And you also talk about libraries very much in that sense. But could you say a word about some of the pools you visited and the way in which they could really be quite illuminating about kind of the heart and soul of a given community?
I think I was writing there about the YMCA pool in Redlands. And just as Jim is a pilot, I am a swimmer. So part of my mission in this was to swim in public pools in every single town that we went to. And like the libraries, you're right, they really, as public institutions and strong public institutions like the YMCA and the community centers and the library, they impart a sense of the town that you don't otherwise always get. You know, when we're going around to talk to people, to teachers or the mayor or the librarian, in some level it's the same strata of the socioeconomics of the town, but when you go to the public pool at the Y, you're in the locker room with people you wouldn't normally otherwise have occasion to run into. And when you're in the locker room naked with other people, there is some sense of vulnerability and I suppose observation is the wrong word, but you know, feeling that you're there without any buffers, rubbing shoulders against the humanity of the town that few other places give you that opportunity to do. So you see at the Y in Redlands, people in the showers, you know that that's the only shower they're going to get because they don't have hot water at home. And you see the upper layer of the economics of the town, maybe the women in the yoga classes in fancy yoga outfits. So everybody is all jumbled up together in places like that, whether it's the pool or the library, but especially the pool somehow, because that's where I spent a lot of time in public institutions. So I really do think that was a very strong lesson that we were able to absorb to see lots of different kinds of life.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with James and Deborah Fallows about their book, Our Towns, a 100,000-mile journey into the heart of America. I do want to thank you for beginning your book, as it were, with the city where I was born, Sioux Falls, South Dakota. I don't know that I deserve this honor, but thank you so much for singling out Sioux Falls, South Dakota for this singular honor. In all seriousness, I really deeply appreciated your observations about Sioux Falls. And in a sense, it's a great place for your book to begin, because Sioux Falls, which somebody who lives in a place like New York City might think of it as a very simple place that doesn't particularly matter, and in the grand scheme of things at least. And you paint this rich, vibrant portrait of this city and all the people who live there and all that goes on there and its successes and its struggles in a way that just leaves us hungry to explore the rest of the book. Can you just share with our listeners a couple of your favorite memories or most intriguing memories about Sioux Falls, South Dakota?
So, Deb, do you want to start or me?
Why don't you start?
So I will confess to you in the secrecy of this interview, since you're a Sioux Falls native, something that is embarrassing but true, that before we spent a couple of weeks in Sioux Falls, I would sometimes make a mental mix-up between Sioux Falls, South Dakota, and Sioux City, Iowa. I know that is because I had not been to either place. I didn't realize how profoundly different, although, you know, not that far away and similar part of the country they were. And that was sort of a sign for how we hadn't realized just all the layers and the vividness and the excitement and the passions going on in Sioux Falls. One of the things, of a million things I could add, one that struck me was the innovation in high-tech agriculture going on there. A pattern we saw all around the country is the way people were adapting their local conditions, the kinds of their geography and their heritage and their natural endowments of one kind or another, to making a future role in the economy. And in Sioux Falls, They were doing that by having these precision-guided GPS tractors, where they would have giant tractors that, you know, as big as a locomotive, that would plant a seed at one precise GPS coordinate, then we'll come back and have a drop of fertilizer there and a drop of pesticide. And just that Sioux Falls, which has a surprising aerospace history and also an obvious farming history, was the center for all this. And also the sense, as you probably know, of how Sioux Falls, the kind of prevailing consciousness there was of people who had come from smaller places in the prairie and felt as if they were in a city that was just the right size, big enough to do so many things, but still small enough to be manageable. But Deb, I pass it to you with some of your school and refugee observations.
Yeah. When we first got to Sioux Falls, I think we were expecting to find what we'd heard, that this was a community that was settled by Nordic, Germanic, ethnic people. And we expected it to be very white and very hardy and very Nordic. What we found was an incredibly rich tapestry of internationalism. 10% of the school population is refugees. Sioux Falls started to take in refugees during the Vietnam resettlement era back in the 70s, and has continued to do that. It started with the religious groups, Catholic Charities, Lutheran Services, Catholic Charities, and became very traditionally successful in resettling wave after wave of refugees into the society. When we were there, it was Sudanese and Somalis and Syrians and Bhutanese and Nepalese, I mean, from all over the world, looking very different, all different kinds of cultures and about 50 different languages going on in the public schools. Sioux Falls has done this in an incredible way, and what you hear from people on the streets are that not any kind of resentment or fear or anxiety about having refugees and immigrants into the town, but rather a vocabulary of, we need each other, we are richer for this. And you see it on the streets and you see it in the schools and how everyone is having to adapt. Everything from in the school lunchrooms during Ramadan, when the Muslim kids are fasting, realizing that it's kind of cruel to make them sit in the lunchroom and watch everybody else eat, so providing a special room where those kids can go because they're fasting. Or when a new culture of people come to town and the policemen who are maybe stopping people for some kind of infraction when they're driving are learning to understand that when the driver is trying to offer them a bribe to get out of the ticket, that's part of their culture, and it shouldn't lead to anything but a well-trained, sympathetic response on how to deal with what Americans would initially think as, oh, you know, are you kidding me? Did you really just try to do this? To a sense of, okay, I'm putting this in context, and this is a learning experience for all of us right now. Mm. So Sioux Falls has gone through many iterations of this and is now a kind of famously welcoming place that has grown itself richer both economically and sociologically and culturally.
And I suspect that lots of people who live, for instance, in the big metropolitan areas on either coast would maybe never dream that a place in the heartland like Sioux Falls, South Dakota, could be such a place.
I think you're right.
and that's just because of the polarization of national level politics, I think people in different parts of the country assume that the various component parts are much more different than they are. And we found we deliberately did not ask people about national politics wherever we went. We asked them about their town, their schools, their businesses, people moving in, people moving out, their problems, their hopes. And there was tremendous commonality of the kinds of things people had in mind. And you wouldn't have any idea which way people in town were going to vote in the national elections, by judging the way they were conducting their business city by city.
And there is something so encouraging about that. A last quick question. For all that you accomplished in this trip, how hungry are you to try to do this again, to launch another similar project and visit still more places across the country?
Jim, you take that.
We are ravenous to do so, setting the hunger metaphor. And so we look forward to learning all about the surrounding Carthage area around the college in Kenosha and Racine and all the rest when we get there.
Well, we would love to see that because we would love to see another book like Our Towns. And you quote Mark Twain in the introduction saying in about a trip that he took by stagecoach, "It had been a fine pleasure trip. We had fed fat on wonders every day." And we are appreciative that you have allowed us as readers of this book to enjoy those wonders as well. The book is Our Towns, a 100,000-mile journey into the heart of America, published by Pantheon Books. And we remind you that James and Deborah Fallows come to Carthage next week, and they will have a special public offering at 7 p.m. in Siebert Chapel on Monday evening, February 18th. This event is free and open to the public. James and Deborah Fallows, I'm profoundly honored at this opportunity to speak with you about your wonderful book, and I wish you well in all of your future travels, including your upcoming trip to Carthage.
Thank you so
Thanks,
much,
Greg.
We really
look forward
appreciate
to
it.
Seeing you.
And to finish out today's morning show, I want to read to you from one of the last sections of the book, Our Towns. It's titled 10.5 Signs of Civic Success. And these are the words of James Fallows. After about a year on the road, Deb and I had evolved a pattern for our first few days in a town. We would make an appointment together at the local newspaper to start on a note of respect and to meet the people most likely to have been thinking analytically about positive and negative trends. Also, the viability of a local paper, or in some cases a local news website, was itself an early and reliable guide to how much there was to a town. After we found a place to stay, downtown if possible, in cities where downtown revival efforts had reached that point, otherwise in a suite-style lodging on the edge of town, we would fan out. Deb would go to the library and the YMCA or similar sports and civic clubs. All of these are surprisingly still relevant bellwether institutions. I would go to the Economic Development Office and the Tech Startup Zone and the Community College. We'd both visit schools. We'd find the local brew pub or distilleries and talk with their founders and owners. In good weather, we'd walk in the parks or ride on the bike trails or go to minor league baseball games. In bad weather or at night, we'd go to the art zones and galleries or the brew pubs again. By the time we had been to half a dozen cities, we'd developed an informal checklist of the traits that distinguished a place where things seemed to work. These items are obviously different in nature. Most of them are subjective, and some of them overlap. But in our experiences, these things were true of the cities, large or small, that were working best. 1. People work together on practical local possibilities rather than allowing bitter disagreements about national politics to keep them apart. We were traveling during the run-up to the bitter midterm elections of 2014, and then while the Supreme Court was ruling on same-sex marriage and Obamacare, and then as to the 2016 presidential campaign, including the Trump insurgency, was gathering steam. People knew we were visiting from Washington, and some learned by asking that I had once worked for a Democratic president. Given the places we were traveling, I imagine that many of the people we interviewed were Trump supporters. But it just didn't come up. Cable TV shows were often playing in the background, most frequently Fox News, and if people had stopped to talk about the TV fair, they might have disagreed with each other and with us. Yet, overwhelmingly, the focus in successful towns was not on insoluble national divisions, but on practical problems a community could address. The more often national politics came into local discussions, the worse shape the town was likely to be in. 2. You can pick out the local patriots. A standard question we'd ask soon after arrival was, who makes this town go? The range of answers varied widely. Sometimes it was a person in an official position of leadership, a mayor or a city council figure. Sometimes it was a local business titan or a real estate developer. Sometimes a university president or professor or a civic activist or an artist or saloon keeper or historian or radio personality. Sometimes a person with no official position, but whose influence everyone felt. What mattered was that the question had an answer. In one city in Appalachia, we asked a newspaper editor that question, and he said that no one came to mind, but he would think about it overnight. In another southern city, the answer was the commanding officer at a nearby military base, but since the command rotated frequently, there was no permanent local patriot. The more quickly this question was answered, the better shape a town was in. 3. The phrase public-private partnership refers to something real. Through the years, I had heard about public-private partnerships, but had thought of this as just another slogan. If it meant anything at all, it was probably a euphemism for sweetheart deals between big government and big business, the public-private partnership to build the latest fighter plane, for instance. In successful towns, people can point to something specific and say, this is what a partnership means. In Greenville, South Carolina, the public school system includes an elementary school of engineering in a poor neighborhood. The city runs the school. The local industries, including GE, BMW, and Michelin, send in engineers to teach and supervise science fairs at the company's expense. In Little Holland, Michigan, a large family-owned scrap recycling company works with the state correctional system to hire ex-convicts who would otherwise have trouble re-entering the workforce. In Fresno, California, a collaboration among the city, county, and state governments, the local colleges and universities, and several tech startup trains high school dropouts and other unemployed people in computer skills. The details vary, but the more specifically a community can explain what their public-private partnership means, the better. 4. People know the civic story. America has a story, one that everyone understands, even if only to say that it's a myth or a lie. A few states have their guiding stories. California is either the ever-promising or the sadly spoiled frontier. Vermont as its own separate Eden. Successful cities seem to have their stories, too. For Sioux Falls, that it's just the right size, big enough so that people who have come from the smaller town prairie can find challenge, stimulation, and opportunity, but small enough to be livable and comfortable. For Columbus, Ohio, which is much larger than Sioux Falls, that it too is exactly right-sized, big enough to make anything possible, small enough actually to get things done. For Bend or Duluth or Winters, that they are in uniquely attractive locations. For Pittsburgh, that it has set an example of successful turnaround. For Eastport or Allentown or Fresno, that they are in the process of doing so. For many of the cities we visited, the civic story turned on the importance of strong local institutions, libraries, schools, philanthropies, public arts projects, annual events. For a surprisingly large number, in the Rust Belt, in the South, in the Plain States, in the non-coastal areas of the West, it involved an awareness of being dismissed or disdained in the fashionable world's eyes, and thus being all the more determined to show what these people and this part of the country could really do. As with guiding national myths, the question is not whether these assessments seem precisely accurate to outsiders. Their value is in giving citizens a sense of how today's efforts are connected to what happened yesterday and what they hope tomorrow will bring. Among the other signs of civic success, they have downtowns, they are near a research university, they have and care about a community college, they have distinctive, innovative schools, they make themselves open, they have big plans. Excerpts from Our Towns, A 100,000-Mile Journey into the Heart of America, by James Fallows and Deborah Fallows, published by Pantheon Books. And we remind you that James Fallows and Deborah Fallows have a free public presentation at Carthage College this Monday evening, February 18th. And you can find more information by going to carthage.edu. I'm Gregory Berg. And tomorrow on The Morning Show, we look forward to the monthly visit of Nan Calvert. Support for The Morning Show comes from Carthage College, welcoming approximately 150 full-time transfer students each year. Eligible Gateway graduates can receive guaranteed admission to Carthage to complete their bachelor's degrees. Transfer to a more personalized education in 4 easy steps. More information about admissions and competitive scholarships for transfers is available at carthage.edu/admissions/transfer. We remind you that The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock, and you will find an extensive archive of past Morning Show interviews